Hello and welcome to the Scottish Housing News podcast. I'm Kieran Finlay, the editor of Scottish Housing News, and with me as always is campaigner and former Dundee Housing convener, Jimmy Black. Joining us today is Craig Stirrett, who having joined Grampian Housing Association in 2014 as Director of Business Development, helped to re-establish its development programme before stepping up to the role of Chief Executive in 2022.
As well as carrying out director roles at the Built Environment Forum Scotland and Fife Housing Group, Craig has served on the boards of CIH Scotland, Housemark and the Scottish Federation of Housing Associations. He was recently recognised by CIH Scotland with a Lifetime Achievement Award for having gone the extra mile during his career, and he still regularly takes to LinkedIn to set the world to rights on many issues, from the cost of living crisis, housing development and climate change.
All this as he marks his 40th year in housing. So Craig, thanks for coming on to the podcast. Before we tackle some of those issues, let's start with the Lifetime Achievement Award. A humbling experience, I'm sure, but one of immense pride as well to be recognised by your peers like that.
Yes, Kieran. I was obviously delighted that my peers nominated me in the first place. I was humbled because, you know, when you're in an audience full of your peers, you recognise a lot of people who are equally worthy of such an award. So I was very fortunate, first of all, to be nominated and absolutely delighted that I received the award. A lot of people think I didn't achieve this on my own, but I was absolutely overwhelmed with the outcome.
Craig, if you're a modest man, then you might find it difficult to or embarrassing to be given awards. But actually, it's important for the housing association world to put themselves forward for awards, isn't it? Because it's one way of getting the message across about what we do.
I absolutely agree with that, Jimmy. I think there's a real crisis of confidence and trust growing amongst our tenants at the moment. And I think we need to improve the image and the perception amongst their tenants and the wider media about what people in the housing world are actually achieving. And, you know, we're all about passion and commitment. It's not just a job, it's a vocation. And I think everyone should be recognised formally in some way for their commitment to the sector and to helping tenants gain access to good quality affordable homes.
How did you get into housing then, Craig? Was it an area that at the time you knew you'd still be working in 40 years?
Yeah, it's a bit of a cliche, you know, how did you get into housing? Well, it wasn't by first choice, but it actually was. I actually tried after leaving university with a sociology degree, and I thought, what do I do with a sociology degree? I did try to get a postgrad course at Heriot Watt that was running both the housing diploma and the town planning diploma at the time. The housing diploma was oversubscribed at the time and I was offered the town planning diploma. So I took that and I successfully completed the first year. But then when an opportunity of a trainee housing manager position came up with Kirkcaldy District Council back in 83, I dropped out because I was getting day released to go to Glasgow. In between that, I'd spent the summer as a student intern with Fountain Bridge Housing Association. So I really have to thank Marion Notman and, from Fountain Bridge, the late Marion Notman, and Selwyn Cambridge, who was then the managing director of Castle Hill, who gave me the opportunity to get some experience in housing. And at that time, Fountain Bridge was at the tail end of a housing action area. So I really got a great insight into the importance of bringing houses up to a proper standard and fit for purpose for the future.
And you got into local government earlier on in your career as well, and you spent some years in local government.
That's absolutely right. I've spent most of my career in local government to date, starting off with Kirkcaldy District Council and then moving on to Aberdeen City Council. I spent my trainee management period with Kirkcaldy, rising to a successful rank of area housing manager. Opportunities came up in Aberdeen then for a wider role area housing manager responsibility. At that time, the city stock was about 40,000 units. There were four areas, and I was the area manager of the west of the city, so that was 10,000 houses I had responsibility for, a wide range of housing from former slum clearance housing, 1930s tenements, to some modern bungalows, and obviously a range of housing needs. So I cut my teeth in both Kirkcaldy and Aberdeen at the time. So a lot to be thankful for the opportunities that I had in local government.
You must have been involved in the days of stock transfer. Tell us about that.
Yes, interesting. Large-scale voluntary stock transfer was a big thing in England in the 90s, and the then Labour government considered one way of getting funding into bringing up council housing up to a good standard was to attract private finance. To that end, they introduced a programme called the New Housing Partnerships, where they invited local authorities to voluntarily bid to get onto the programme. Now, Aberdeen City Council in the late 90s was one of the authorities that successfully put in a bid to join the programme of seven local authorities across Scotland who participated in the programme. Now, the aim of this was to undertake an assessment of the viability and the ways in which Aberdeen, if it transferred its stock to a third party, a housing association or housing associations, could go about getting the necessary investment. And so that required, at that time, something that was quite innovative in the sense that we started introducing business planning, which housing associations themselves had done for many years. Underpinning that business planning was a comprehensive stock condition survey. Now, that might seem not very novel today because most social landlords will do that, but that was quite radical at the time to have a comprehensive stock condition survey. Naturally, one of the major challenges that we found at the time was the fact that 11% of our stock at that time was multi-storey and required significant investment to bring it up to current standards and be fit for purpose. Now, that represented 59 multi-stories, many of which in the city centre had high levels of sales, i.e. right-to-buy occupants in these properties. So that was a major challenge for us. As it turns out, as we progress with consultation with communities and the tenants and obviously the council members themselves, the government at the same time introduced a scheme called prudential borrowing, which basically allowed local authorities to borrow as much as they were able to afford from the Public Works Loan Board. So in a sense, that pulled the rug from underneath their own initiative to encourage local authorities to transfer their stock to rid debt and track private sector funding. And Aberdeen responded to that. And I think the rest is history in that Aberdeen has recently been reported as having one of the highest debts per resident in the whole of the UK. It's in the top 10. Now, that's not to say having debt is a bad thing, but the challenge is, can you afford to service that debt when you're trying to ensure that tenants remain in a quality home that's serviced by affordable rents? Out of the failed stock transfer programme in Aberdeen, we still were faced with a conundrum. How do we get significant investment to bring our property, our multi-storey properties, up to a good standard? And we looked at we did an options appraisal. We looked at a number of ways in which we could do it. And the most cost-effective at that time was to group multis into a network and provide combined heat with power to those properties, i.e. providing affordable heat and energy to both tenants and right-to-buy owner-occupiers in these properties. And that was a very successful project. So out of the fire rose the phoenix of the combined heat with power, which remains to this day successful, albeit the current challenge now is to decarbonise the combined heat and power facilities because they rely on gas. So that's just one example of how we were trying to be innovative to get more investment into the stock, because the answer when we asked for extra funding was that you either increase your rents or you transfer your stock.
Well, there is another option, is you can demolish all your multis, which is what Dundee set out to do and North Lanarkshire are now setting out to do, and certainly demolish a lot of them. So, and you still have lots of multis in Aberdeen, so clearly you're not the landlord of those multis anymore.
That's absolutely right. There are still 59 multi-stories in Aberdeen, and many of them face a lot of challenges because it's like maintaining a cruise liner or an oil tanker. It requires constant maintenance. The challenge is that, particularly in the city centre multis, is that some of the multis have about 40 to 50% owner occupiers on them now. The council recently undertook a survey that indicated that the owners were actually quite happy with living in their flats, and although they haven't seen the bills that are going to come in the near future. Demolition, it requires obviously a supply of housing to decant people from their homes. And at the time when we were looking at that, we just didn't have alternative accommodation to provide people if we had to demolish multi-stories. And that's not to say that Aberdeen's multi-stories are not successful. I think that's a great legacy that in some ways Aberdeen has not had to demolish these houses to date, these multi-stories, but that may come. I mean, things change and not all the multi-stories are as popular as some of them are. So certainly as we move forward, there's going to be significant investment required in the multi-stories in Aberdeen and some tough decisions. But one of the challenges facing Aberdeen, and particularly the city centre, is that a number of these multis have now been listed.
Craig, you're a great proponent of social housing as an established professional career. You've written for Scottish Housing News about how you feel the sector should consider introducing a regulatory requirement for housing qualifications. Why is that so important?
Well, I consider that particularly in local government, I perceive that the role of the social landlord has diminished. I think we need to raise standards of quality of service across the board, not just in local government. And, you know, there's many challenges that have to be faced in each local authority. They're all different. One of the things that I think needs to be established is a statutory chief officer, strategic chief officer for housing, to provide direction to all social landlords in the area. That's one requirement, because I think that's been lost with the generalisation of council services. Most services are now grouped into thematic services rather than opposed to specific strategic roles. So, for instance, local housing strategy is now part of the planning strategy, and the management and maintenance of the stock in some authorities is asset management. So it's a generic term. It's not customer focused. In terms of my perception about a crisis of confidence and trust growing amongst the tenants, I think we need to instill more pride and confidence in the sector. And like many, I do believe strongly in attaining professional standards to help protect the public, to maintain their confidence in us as landlords, to declare and uphold professional standards, and to clearly set out a threshold of standards that are necessary to protect the tenants and the general public. So I think it sets out clear expectations of what it is that we are required to do to support our tenants and look after the stock for future generations. I also strongly believe in continuous professional development, and I think having the framework of a professional qualification gives you that focus. And personally, I don't think I would have been able to do what I have done without being part of a professional body. I have learnt so much by attending Chartered Institute of Housing conferences over the years and training that have inspired me to see beyond what was immediately in front of me and to realise what opportunities there are to make a difference in people's lives.
During your time in housing, you'll have seen associations and local authorities deal with many crisis situations, homelessness, financial crash, COVID, and now, of course, the cost of living crisis. How has Grampian Housing Association been supporting its tenants through these, and how has it changed Grampian as an association?
Well, like a number of housing associations, we've recognised that there's been a slow and sure decline of a safety net for many people in communities. Services that once were quite prolifically provided by local authorities and charitable organisations have slowly edged back. There was obviously a rise in the late 70s and early 80s in a lot of charitable organisations to help homeless households or homeless persons, to help people who are got mental health issues or substance misuse issues. Local authorities often funded these services. Many local authorities provided these services directly. And what we've been seeing over the last 20 years, in particular, a slow but steady reduction in direct access to a lot of these services. A lot of these services have had to be repurposed and centralised. And I don't think the support has been there in recent years as it had been in the past. This has necessitated the role of the traditional housing officer to change. And we've had to change to ensure that we sustain people in their tenancies to prevent homelessness and also naturally to reduce the costs to the housing association and its tenants by having a high turnover of housing. So how Grampian in particular has responded to that, we worked in collaboration with a number of other local RSLs in the Northeast at one time to access money from various sources, and we collaborated and set up two services, one called SMART, which was a money advice and lobbying agency to help people get access to the appropriate funding. We also set up Assist, which was, as it says in the tin, to assist tenants to sustain their tenancies by providing appropriate support to people who are suffering either mental health or either some other challenge of behaviour, and again act as advocates on behalf of these tenants to ensure that they get access to the services they need to improve their well-being and keep them safe in their own homes. So we've done that in the past, and we've continued with these services even when funding from the National Lottery has dried up. We've funded that directly. So in other words, all tenants are paying for these services. When the funding dried up, naturally the collaboration ended, as well as each housing association considered that they would either have to stop the service or fund it from their own rent. So we've continued with that service over the last 10 years. It's been continues to be successful. Like many RSLs, our SMART team access various grants, most recently funding that's been helping with cost of living through the SFHA and other sources. And we've also accessed grant funding to train all our frontline officers on energy efficiency to assist tenants with managing more effectively their energy consumption, and obviously making sure they're getting on the right tariffs for the types of heating systems they have. Because that's one of the things we're finding with greening the stock, that many tenants are finding it difficult to transition from carbon-based heating systems, i.e. gas, that people, generations have grown up with, and to move into more green-type electrical-based heating systems, such as air source heat pumps. So it's a real challenge for tenants to cope with that. And to that end, we've provided training through funding to assist tenants in these ways. So that's just one example.
But it's really crucial that you do enable tenants to live with these new systems. And it's also essential that you do something about the older housing and refit it. You've been doing some very interesting things. For example, there's a community heating network in Turriff that you've been involved with, which uses, if I've got this right, uses one air source heat pump to heat a whole lot of other houses and combines that with solar panels as well to provide electric heating. And you've used air source heat pumps, and you've used a ground source heat pump at Ballater, I think. So
yes,
you're ahead of the game, and you're doing things that other associations are just thinking about. What exactly is the problem for tenants with living with these new systems?
Yeah, certainly, thanks for acknowledging that, Jimmy. We have been doing a lot of pioneering work recently. We've been committed to helping tenants transition from gas central heating to more renewable type heating. It's a lifestyle change. The way these new greener heating systems heat your homes is different than gas central heating, when it's almost instant with gas central heating. You know, you can program it to come on when you need it, and the radiators normally reach a temperature that provides the necessary comfort for each household. What we've been finding with ground source and air source is that obviously you have to have a larger radiator installed, and it has to be a more constant heat. And obviously, if you've got a larger radiator, it's radiating a lower level temperature, but a more consistent approach. And people are used to these gas central heating being on and responsive, whereas you really need to leave the air source and ground source on as background heating to maintain a proper temperature, constant temperature, so that the house doesn't go hot and cold. And there is even, you know, perceptions when we say we're moving to green heating, that people have complained to us and say, my electricity bill has gone through the roof since you put in this air source heat pump or ground source heat pump. And we've had to explain and point out to some tenants that, well, yes, but you don't have a gas bill now.
Yes.
But they will say, yeah, I know that, but I didn't expect my electricity bill to go through the roof. And we say, well, you know, if you look at it in the total, what you were paying in total for gas and electricity and what you're paying now in terms of air source, which is supplemented by PV, and in some of our other developments, PV and batteries, overall, you are having a cheaper, a more affordable heating solution, which is also meeting the targets that we need to do to greener properties. But that's sometimes, on the face of it, a simple message, but a difficult one to convey to some people. I'll never forget when I joined Fifehousen, they had passive house properties, and the tenants, I remember, complained to say, why we still got electric bills? I thought this was zero cost housing. It's not zero cost, it's zero carbon. They didn't think they would have bills still to pay, zero energy, so zero bills. But we had to point out you need ventilation systems to circulate air. You also have your ongoing costs of cooking and lighting and powering all your various appliances, etc. And other things people had remarked about, well, where they were hanging your washing, there's no radiators in these houses. So what in the face of it might seem trivial is very important to people when they've had a lifetime of growing up with gas central heating, where you had radiators which you could hang your washing on a wet day, etc., etc. So it might seem trivial, as I said, but for many tenants, these are important issues. And, you know, the transition and understanding of that will take time to get through. So in many respects, if you look at the social rented sector compared to private rented or the owner-occupied sector, we're asking a lot of tenants to change their lifestyles for the benefit of the rest of society. So they're the guinea pigs on all this new technology.
Craig, where's Grampian's future development programme sitting at the moment? Last year's SNP conference, you talked about the development plan having to be reduced. You mentioned that one of the issues is a lack of skilled tradesmen, a lot of people leaving, retiring from the sector without having the apprentices coming to replace them. And that was, of course, before the Scottish Government's budget, with a proposed £200 million plus cut to the affordable housing funding. Where does that leave Grampian's development plan now?
We are aiming to try and continue with a modest programme of development. I have to say, Kieran, it may be a challenge in the next 2 or 3 years for a number of reasons. One being that obviously with the recent self-imposed rent control from last year and previously during COVID, we had a zero rent increase. That's naturally had a compound impact on the amount of income we have to invest in our current stock. We, like many housing associations, we have carried out stock condition surveys to estimate how much investment is required. But what we're finding is that maybe the level of investment has been underestimated because of fabric issues, and certainly the impact of the recent climate change issues with storms and that, it's exposed us to a lot of cost that we hadn't anticipated. So naturally, our capacity to borrow has to be constrained by our commitment and requirement to invest in our current stock, something that a couple of years ago just wasn't on my radar. But I suspect many RSLs are considering the same thing because of previous rent restraints, either at a national level or a local level, because of the concerns about the impact on tenants and the cost of living. But equally, there is the cost of borrowing. That's another challenge. We had anticipated that interest rates might reduce sooner rather than later. So what we are having to do, probably like many housing associations are, is to slow down the programme in anticipation that interest rates may reduce at the end of this year, 2024, because last year, when we drew down money for investment, it added another £1 million to our expenditure. And that is something that wasn't really compensated for by increased rents. So that meant we had to cut our cloth in terms of investment in the current stock according to the material. So it's a bit of a robbing Peter to pay Paul, but we still are aiming to, over the next 3 years, to at least build 100 houses a year. That's what we're currently planning to do, but that will be reviewed in light of the Scottish Government's decision to cut budgets by between 20 to 25% in terms of the affordable housing programme. So we may be faced with having to choose between developments that we had planned for this year and next year on the basis of, well, what is our priority now? We've only got so much grant that is available to us via the local authority ships in Moray, Aberdeen and Aberdeenshire, which is the most demanding development that we have. So we're going to have to prioritise, just in the same way local authorities themselves are going to have to prioritise how they allocate out the grants to housing associations that are developing.
Craig, you have mid-market rents and you have full market rental properties. Now, the Scottish Government's been limiting rent increases in the private sector, the new developments recently. Is it still sensible for you to be developing mid-market rent, and I don't know how you acquire your full market properties, but is that still a viable business for you into the future?
Surprisingly, it has still remained viable in Aberdeen, despite the fact that, you know, in 2017, private rented sector rents in Aberdeen were the highest of the major cities in Scotland. It is now, on average, the lowest private sector rent across the major cities in Scotland. So the differential between mid-market and private rented has diminished. We provided mid-market as an option for those households who had little or no priority for social rent, but equally didn't have sufficient income to access good quality housing in the private rented sector. So we haven't seen a downturn in the demand despite what's happened in Aberdeen, because we have seen a number, as we've seen across Scotland, a number of landlords, private landlords, actually disposing of their properties. So there's been a slight increase in the private rented sector. So the differential between our mid-market and the private rented sector market is growing. So there is, I consider, still a long-term need for it. A particular need that has not gone away, albeit it's not talked about as much now, is key worker accommodation. Now, we embarked on a partnership with Grant Payen NHS a few years ago now, because they had a problem recruiting and retaining health workers, particularly nurses and doctors. So we developed a mid-market project on site at the Aberdeen Royal Infirmary site, providing in total 101 houses, of which the majority are mid-market, but we've also got about 30 which are for social rent out of the 101. That is targeted at the lower paid NHS workers, such as the cleaners, auxiliaries and porters. So that has been and remains very popular mid-market accommodation. It's all about location, location, location at the end of the day. These are high quality, energy efficient flats right on the doorstep of the hospital. And it's in the west end of Aberdeen, that's where the hospital's. So, you know, highly desirable area to live in as well.
Craig, you expressed some forthright views recently about the UK government's ideas on extending the right to buy. But you also hinted that you might support right to buy as a means of rebalancing communities. What did you mean?
I do believe in balanced communities. Naturally, I've become a gamekeeper turned poacher when leaving a mono-tenure council housing landlord area. I've seen the benefits of creating more balanced, tenure-neutral housing where tenants aren't stigmatised because they're in council housing and their life chances and opportunities are not limited because of where they stay or what's the tenure of their accommodation. So certainly where you've got a mix, I would have particular blocks where there's opportunities, because as we know in England, a lot of the housing associations down there, actually one of their primary purposes now is to build houses for sale and also for shared ownership, etc. And that's what we've done here. We've we've tried to encourage many tenants to get on the ladder by providing shared ownership. We've over 400 units still in shared ownership. So
as long as the money is reinvested, and importantly, in acquiring or developing more housing, then it can work.
Well, absolutely. And that's the problem with the original right to buy, that money wasn't being reinvested at the time. It was just going back into the treasury coffers and then reallocated out through borrowing consents for the various local authorities at the time. And those borrowing consents were naturally limited by how much they could afford to borrow with the rental income that they have at their disposal. So if you can recycle right to buy receipts into providing more affordable, fit-for-purpose housing, I've no issue with that. I do think when we closed the gate on right to buy in Scotland, it was after the horses bolted. I do remember making a comment like that in the public forum, and it went down like a lead balloon because everybody had been fighting for right to buy for years. But, you know, I just felt it was too little too late. And, you know, the horse had bolted. But yeah, it's great. I mean, certainly took the threat against housing associations out of the right to buy sector, which was a good thing, because that would just blow housing associations' business plan models out the window. Mm-hmm. But I honestly can't remember what I said about right to buy in England at the time. So you've caught me out now. I must admit.
Well, you weren't very keen on it. Now, recently, we've seen the members of Readvale Housing Association flex their muscles and stop a transfer to Places for People. Well, certainly for the moment, stop it, after tenants voted in favour. So members or shareholders of housing associations have the kind of power which can frustrate the board of management. Should we be looking after the members better?
Certainly, it does seem a contradiction asking tenants to vote for something and then somebody else to unilaterally overturn that decision. It's a bit like the rent consultations that have been happening in local authorities up here recently. Officers naturally have put forward proposals on options for rent increases to enable them to invest in their stock. Then when it's come before the council, the council has decided to ignore these options and go for a lower rent increase. So similarly, Readvale, it's a difficult one to comment on because I don't know the politics down there, but it does seem to me that there's point political principles going on here about the independence of small RSLs, and I've naturally read in Scottish Housing News, you know, concerns about whether the regulator has an agenda and political comments that they need to refocus their agenda. The regulator is well aware of that concern and has publicly said time and time again they have no agenda. But when you look at regulatory engagement, I think it's no surprise that you find that most engagement is with the smaller, more community-based RSLs. There seems to be something in that. That's not to say that some larger housing associations have not had engagement with the regulator over failure to meet certain standards. But I think if you were looking at a standard deviation curve of this, you would find most of the engagement is around smaller housing associations or co-ops.
Part of the problem might be just the sheer volume of regulation that housing association committee members have to deal with. I notice that some of the recent acquisitions to your board include, I think a professor is a professor your chair?
Yes.
Yep, and you've got a solicitor who's just recently joined.
Yes.
And various other professionals. And I wonder, how feasible is it for housing associations to run with lay members, if you like? Is it necessary that you basically stuff your board with professionals, because otherwise it's just too much for people to take in?
I think it's a big ask for whether you're professional or a lay person. It's a huge responsibility and commitment to provide the level of governance, as you say, Jimmy, is expected of boards. I have had first-hand experience being on the board of a, for want of a better word, tenant-led housing association, a small association, which I'm not going to mention, but my experience there was that the tenants were naturally more focused on key tenant issues and day-to-day issues rather than the business issues of making sure that the association continues to operate efficiently and effectively. And it was probably no surprise to myself after I left. Now, I didn't leave because of that. I left because I moved job and returned to the Northeast. But there was intervention then by the regulator, and radical changes came about as a consequence of that. But they retained their independence. Looking at professionals, certainly as suggested and promoted by the regulator, we do an assessment in terms of gaps and skills. So naturally, we have to have more informed people about what is expected. Housing association must do to ensure that it's been run properly. So being based in the Northeast, certainly we have a lot of people from the private sector who come into our board who wish to make a difference, wish to make a contribution to society, to give back. And so we perhaps have gone a wee bit too far that way. You do need to balance it with life experience and what, at the end of the day, the housing association exists to do. And sometimes you could get the balance wrong, and it could become too business orientated without focusing on, the purpose we're here for is the betterment of tenants and to meet an unmet need when it's focused more on the governance. So trying to get that balance sometimes is a difficult one. Some housing association may have cracked it, but there's always areas for improvement where we are, and certainly I've recognised in other housing associations that they've suffered because of the perceived business head has been overruled by their social heart.
Craig, we're coming to the end of the podcast now. I've got some quick fire questions for you. If you can keep your answers quite short as well, that would be very helpful. The term affordable housing, is it useful or is it too broad brush?
I think it's too broad brush. It
Yeah.
means different things in England than it does in Scotland. So, yes, we need to come up with a new term.
Tenants or customers?
Tenants.
Always.
Well, we do have customers as well. Grampian, for instance, provides a range of services, not just for social tenants. We've factor donors, we've home seekers who are seeking homes and advice and options. So I tend to interchange depending on the audience that we're dealing with, and sometimes I have a double barrel, tenants that lead customers. But first and foremost, we're a social landlord.
And I did come up with this question in December when we were first due to do this interview. It'll be February before people hear this, but what were your housing New Year resolutions?
My housing resolution is to ensure that Grampian Housing Association remains financially stable and resilient whilst ensuring that we continue to work on improving our offer to our tenants.
Well, I'm sure with yourself at the helm, Grampian will have a very good chance of doing so. Thanks, Craig, for your time. It's much appreciated. Thanks to Jimmy Black, my co-host. I'm Kieran Finlay, and we'll be back with another podcast in a couple of weeks. Thank you.